From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter Rodown. This is Here and Now. The CDC is still trying to defend last week's decision to lift most mask restrictions for fully vaccinated people. Director Rochelle Walensky spoke yesterday on ABC's This Week.
This is not permission for widespread removal of masks for those who are vaccinated. It may take some time for them to feel comfortable removing their masks. These decisions have to be made at the jurisdictional level, at the community level.
The new CDC guidance does not have any specific advice for vaccinated parents with unvaccinated children, so there are still lots of questions. Let's try to dig into some of them with Dr. Emily Landon. She's an infectious disease specialist at the University of Chicago, also a mom. Dr. Landon, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure, we're glad to have you now. A lot of people were out this weekend for the first time making the choice to take the mask off because of these new rules from the CDC. Did you see any situations with masking in public that concerned you?
Actually, here in Chicago, the vast majority of people are still wearing masks. I think the city here has not come out with an expectation about what they're going to do with the local mask mandates. And so most people are still abiding by them, and most businesses still have their signs up saying that everyone's expected to wear a mask.
It's part of the reason it's confusing, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a little bit rushed. And I think another issue is that they didn't really include any, the CDC did not include any guidance about the evidence that is equally strong, just as strong as the evidence that the vaccine works really well. There's also great evidence that people who are unvaccinated or unprotected by their vaccine are much safer when both they and their contacts are wearing masks, which leaves politicians, decision makers, businesses in a really sticky situation.
And I think from what I can tell, based on a recent Twitter post that you made, this is kind of personal for you. You said that you do have rheumatoid arthritis. It's an autoimmune disease. You have been vaccinated, but you are also at higher risk. So what does this mean for people like you?
Yeah, so there are about 4 to 5% of American adults are immunocompromised in some way. That's based on data from 2016, and that percentage is probably higher now than it was then. Even fully vaccinated, we don't know enough about how well the vaccines protect people like me, people with cancer, people with other autoimmune diseases, people who have any sort of immunodeficiency like HIV or AIDS. And so we're scrambling to gather as much information as we can. So far, what we know is that those who've undergone a transplant or who are actively receiving chemotherapy that makes their white count low do not get any benefit from the vaccine and probably need to be considered the same as an unvaccinated individual, but they should still be vaccinated in the hopes that it provides some background help.
I also mentioned that you're a mom. You have a 12-year-old, and the CDC director didn't directly answer a question yesterday about whether it's safe for unvaccinated children to be in crowded places such as grocery stores, even in a mask, when it's possible that there are unvaccinated maskless people there as well. So what do you think about that? What should parents be doing?
Yeah, I mean, I have to tell you, it's a bit of a slap in the face as a parent and as an immunocompromised individual, knowing that the data is much, much stronger. If my child, who's had his first dose of vaccine, but it'll be about 5 weeks before he's fully vaccinated, and myself, that we are safer if both we are masked and the other people around us are masked. And without that extra sort of, and it's not just extra, it's actually really important to protecting us to have the people around us masked as well, especially if they're unvaccinated. It's a really difficult decision to make about what places we can and cannot go. I'm just not sure, but Trader Joe's took away their mask mandate. They're right next to me on the ground floor of the building next door, but I'm not going there for my groceries now.
I have just about a minute here left with you. You know, we're hearing about some breakthrough infections. The New York Yankees said yesterday that yet another staff member has tested positive for COVID. All 9 had been fully vaccinated with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. 7 of them were asymptomatic. How concerned should we be about breakthrough infections like this as masks start to come off for many people?
Well, breakthrough infections are very real. We expect up to 10% of individuals who are fully vaccinated and immune and with normal immune systems to develop breakthrough infections. That's what 90 to 95% efficacy means. Great news is that for the vast majority of those people, the infection will be mild to nothing and probably won't even result in transmission. That is some of the evidence that is underlying the CDC's recommendation. And that's great for fully vaccinated individuals who are in contact with other fully vaccinated individuals. But I think the issue with the Yankees is that there's some chance that there was some transmission from a fully vaccinated individual with a symptomatic infection. And that's where I think we need the data's good, but I wouldn't say it's settled science.
All right, let's leave it right there for now. Dr. Emily Landon, infectious disease specialist at the University of Chicago, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, to India, where for the first time in weeks, the daily number of new infections dropped below 300,000 as that country deals with a ferocious surge of COVID-19. The health ministry reported about 280,000 new cases and still 4,100 deaths in the last 24 hours. We're also seeing the pictures of bodies in low-lying areas or washing up on the banks of the Ganges River. The speculation is that they are COVID-19 victims that couldn't be cremated. And as if this wasn't enough, there's a cyclone on the way. NPR's Lauren Frayer joins us from the NPR Bureau in Mumbai. And Lauren, is that rain we hear there, is that the approaching cyclone?
It is. I mean, you can hear this howling wind and rain behind me probably. Actually, part of the NPR Bureau's roof has sheared off this afternoon. I'm looking out the window at these palm trees swaying sort of way too much back and forth. About 150,000 people have been evacuated to the north of me in the state of Gujarat, where the cyclone is expected to make landfall later tonight. But here in Mumbai, hundreds of patients have been shifted out of these makeshift COVID wards, sort of flimsier temporary buildings, into hospitals farther inland. Miraculously, where I am, we still have power. But that is the main concern, especially for these industrial plants generating medical oxygen for India's COVID patients. I'm going to close my window now.
Yeah, go ahead and close that. I was saying, boy, to hear an approaching cyclone is quite something. But we'll hear more about its impact. But things had been looking up in India, correct?
Today is the first day in about 25 days that India's daily infections, known infections, have dropped below the 300,000 mark. But we're not exactly sure that that means this wave has peaked, because what's happening is that the wave is now moving into rural areas. Two-thirds of Indians live in rural areas, and they have far less access to coronavirus testing and medical care. So even though the numbers appear to be down nationwide, rural cases just might not be getting counted. And deaths are still high, as you mentioned, more than 4,100 today alone. I've been talking to scientists who say these figures are a vast undercount, and the real figures could be 5 million infections per day, maybe 10,000 deaths per day. So we talk about India as officially being second to the U.S. in terms of total cases. But, you know, scientists say it probably is already the worst death tolls and worst infection tolls in the world here.
And where are we on the country improving on getting vaccinations to people? 3 million miles of roads there. I mean, has it gotten any better?
No. I mean, actually, Mumbai, where I am, has stopped all vaccinations for 4 days because of this cyclone. But even before that, appointments have been canceled, vaccine centers closed here and across India. 2.5 weeks ago, the government opened up vaccinations to anyone over the age of 18, but it just didn't have the doses to do it. And so some areas now have scaled back eligibility to now over 45. So you've got people who've gotten their first dose who now aren't eligible for a second dose. The government has also lengthened the waiting period between doses here. Now it's 12 to 16 weeks, you know, up to 4 months waiting between shots. This is a huge turnaround. I mean, India is the world's biggest vaccine maker, but it just didn't make enough of these COVID shots. And now it was exporting them. Now it's importing them. In fact, the first shot of Russia's Sputnik vaccine was administered here last Friday.
And what about this horrible image, these bodies washing up on the shores of the Ganges River? Do we know these are people who died from COVID?
We actually put calls out to several local politicians and aid workers in those villages where the bodies have been washing up along the banks of the Ganges River. And they say, you know, some locals, this is actually a practice that some people there have done all along, immersing bodies of their loved ones in the Holy River instead of cremating them. You know, that said, the price of wood for funeral pyres has gone up. It's much more expensive. A lot of rural folks are really suffering under coronavirus lockdowns. They've lost their jobs. They can't afford to cremate their loved ones. There is a long Hindu sacred tradition of immersing ashes in the Ganges. But now what we're seeing is, you know, whole bodies being immersed in the river. It's really difficult to know who these people are, and local people, you know, understandably, are really unhappy about this global attention and traumatized themselves.
And there is a cyclone heading your way. NPR's Lauren Freyer speaking with us from Mumbai, India. Lauren, thank you so much. Stay safe, obviously, but thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
The fighting in Israel in the Gaza Strip has entered its second week. Israeli warplanes bombarded Gaza City this morning. Hamas continues lobbing rockets on southern cities in Israel. Roughly 200 Palestinians have died, and officials say nearly half of them are women and children. Israel has reported at least 10 dead. Of course, many more people have suffered in the long history of this conflict. Since Hamas took control of the Gaza Strip in 2007, Israel and Egypt have blockaded the region. And with that in mind, we want to try to answer some of the fundamental questions that get to the root of what's happening right now. Khalid El-Gindi is director of the Palestinian-Israeli Affairs at the Middle East Institute. Khalid, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I do want to get to the blockade in just a moment. But first, how did it come to be that millions of Palestinians are living in the Gaza Strip?
Well, the Gaza Strip, of course, is an entirely artificial creation that emerged in 1948 when roughly 3/4 of Palestine's Arab population was displaced, in some cases expelled, during the course of Israel's creation. And most of the refugees were sort of scattered across the region in neighboring countries like Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. Some went to the West Bank, which came under Jordanian rule after 1948, and a very large number went to the Gaza Strip, which is right, this tiny little coastal strip between Egypt and what is now Israel. Today, the population of Gaza, about 70% of Gaza's population, are refugees.
Can they leave the Gaza Strip, the Palestinians?
No. I mean, usually they have a one border crossing with Egypt, and the other border crossings, the land crossings, are all with Israel. Egypt will occasionally open their border crossing for humanitarian assistance, like in the current crisis. But for the most part, the border is closed.
Can you explain why? So this blockade in 2007, why did the Israelis do that? And what has the effect been on daily life inside the Gaza Strip?
Well, the stated reason for the blockade on Gaza was Hamas. Yeah, Hamas forcibly took control of the Gaza Strip in 2007. Shortly thereafter, the Israelis imposed a complete closure on Gaza's borders. They declared Gaza to be an enemy entity. Of course, Gaza is not a state. Hamas, of course, is viewed by Israel and by much of the international community as a terrorist organization,
including
the United States, for their history of attacks on civilians and so forth. And so that was the stated official reason for imposing this blockade, to not allow Gaza to function normally, not to have a normal economy, to cripple the civilian infrastructure as a way of putting pressure on Hamas.
Has that happened? No,
of course not. I mean, if anything, the blockade on Gaza has strengthened Hamas, because the 2 million Palestinians who live there are completely dependent on whatever Hamas does to provide basic sustenance in Gaza. So you have this population that is completely dependent either on international aid or whatever economic and infrastructural developments the Hamas-run authority can bring to the people in Gaza. So life in Gaza is miserable. 97% of the water is unfit for human consumption. 50% of the workforce is unemployed. And the majority of the population lives on food aid from the outside world.
So Israel would point out that from their perspective, Hamas is an existential threat, that Hamas wants to wipe Israel off the map. How do Palestinians feel, everyday Palestinians inside the Gaza Strip, considering the conditions that are existing there? How do they feel about Hamas and their governing tactics?
Well, of course, Hamas has its political base. They have they are at least the second largest political force in all of Palestinian politics, second only to Fatah party of Mahmoud Abbas, which dominates in the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. And so they have a strong following historically. I think a lot of Palestinians have grown very disaffected from both leaderships because they have essentially failed. The Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority have failed in their project to create a Palestinian state through negotiations and diplomacy. And the Hamas authority in Gaza has failed to, certainly has failed to liberate Palestine or to bring about Palestinian independence or even a lifting of the grinding blockade in Gaza. So there's a broad sense of alienation, I think, from both of these leaderships on the part of Palestinians. And I think to add on top of that, I think a lot of Palestinians are frustrated with, we know that when Hamas launches rockets into Israel, that Israel's response will be far more devastating than anything Hamas hopes to achieve damage-wise on the Israeli side. And so I think there is also a frustration there. But again, I think Palestinians don't really have a say here. They are on the receiving end of Israeli bombs and artillery. And in times like this, people tend to sort of rally around the flag. They will even rally around a leadership that they dislike because it's their only hope. And the reality is that while the kind of official talking points in Israel is that Hamas is entirely responsible for any death and destruction, not just on the Israeli side that they inflict, but whatever Israel inflicts also on the Palestinian side, Hamas is purely responsible. That argument is extremely disingenuous because it's Israel's choice to use overwhelming disproportionate force. And there is no Palestinian who will blame, they may blame Hamas, I think, for their poor decision-making. But the carnage that we see in Gaza, the overwhelming majority of Palestinians put the blame squarely on Israel.
So how does Hamas get its weapons if there is a closed border and the blockade? How do they get through?
Well, typically they've had a very elaborate secret network of tunnels that go under the Gaza-Egypt border, and in some cases tunnels that burrow into Israel for to be able to launch surprise attacks whenever they can. Part of the problem is that in neighboring Sinai, which is Egyptian territory, you have a bit of a security vacuum. There is a kind of low-level insurgency happening there, and the Egyptian state is not necessarily in control of all parts of the Sinai Peninsula. And so there's a very robust arms trade and collaboration between insurgent groups and militant groups in the Sinai adjacent to the Gaza Strip. And so that's one key avenue for Hamas to get weapons, which can be procured from Iran or from elsewhere. As long as you keep Gaza under this kind of intense pressure, whether it's Hamas or someone else, they will always find a way to obtain weapons and to pose some sort of threat to Israel. So the idea that Israel can solve all these problems through overwhelming military force just hasn't panned out. These are political problems. The blockade is a political issue. Hamas is a political issue. The occupation of the rest of the West Bank and Gaza, that is a political issue. And you simply cannot just deal with everything in security and military terms, which is Israel's preference in order to avoid having to make any political concessions.
Khaled Al-Ghindi is Director of Palestinian-Israeli Affairs at the Middle East Institute. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
And I want to update you now on a story that we did last week. Remember the tiger that was stalking the suburbs of Houston?
A tiger in my neighborhood.
There's a freaking tiger.
He has a collar. It is somebody's pet.
Well, that pet tiger was only 9 months old, and after spending a week on the lam, one of his alleged former owners helped turn him over to the authorities. Jiva Cuevas can be heard here in a police video petting the tiger along with Houston officer Ron Borza.
Commander, it's been a long week for looking for this guy.
It really has. But we got him, and he's healthy.
India's husband, Victor Hugo Cuevas, first claimed to know India's owner, but police say he actually was the owner. He was out on bond for a murder charge. Now he's back in jail. But India is starting a new life at an animal sanctuary. Here's Noel Almrud, director of the Cleveland Amory Black Beauty Ranch, speaking on CNN today.
We're so happy he's here. He's doing well. He's adjusting very well. And we're just hopeful he'll be here for the rest of his life.
India is kept isolated from the other animals for now. A team of veterinarians are testing him for diseases that are common to captive tigers. Like many Americans, his quarantine may soon come to an end. And we wish him well. We're glad that everyone is safe.
I'm Yoe Shaw.
I'm Kia Miakonatis.
We're the hosts of the NPR podcast, Invisibilia.
You can think of Invisibilia kind of like a sonic blacklight.
When you switch us on, you will hear surprising and intimate stories.
Stories that help you notice things in your world that maybe you didn't see before.
Listen to the Invisibilia podcast from NPR.
Vaccination rates for COVID-19 in Canada continue to lag far behind the U.S., largely due to a shortage in vaccines there. Just 3% of Canadians have been fully immunized, as many provinces delay second shots to deliver more first doses. Canada is also struggling with a third wave of the virus. And now a number of American border communities with ample vaccine supply are vaccinating their Canadian neighbors. Emma Jacobs reports in this story that originally aired on Weekend Edition.
Canada and the U.S. have limited travel over the border for more than a year, but John Harrower still crosses twice a week under exemptions for truck drivers maintaining the country's integrated supply chains. He'll pick up potash from a mine a few hours from his home in Manitoba.
I will take that into South Dakota, and then I could pick up anything, but typically it's soy meal, and then I'll bring that back into Canada.
Harrower was on the road last month when he heard on the radio that North Dakota had agreed to vaccinate Manitoba drivers.
I phoned and I talked to this lovely lady named Doris at North Dakota Health, and she made my appointment for the next time I was coming past the rest stop.
North Dakota's governor said last month they'll vaccinate several thousand Canadian truck drivers at roadside clinics and may also add oil workers. Most Manitobans are waiting 4 months for second doses, but North Dakota, with ample supply, can deliver second doses within weeks. Montana, on Monday, began vaccinating truckers from one of its neighboring provinces, Alberta. The Native American Blackfoot Confederacy crosses both. Health Director Bonnie Healy said over Zoom that the southern portion had achieved a 98% vaccination rate by April, with hundreds of extra doses.
And then it got to be urgent because their supply was going to expire if not used.
The Blackfeet obtained special permission to hold two vaccination clinics at the border, opening the second to the general Canadian public.
People were lining up in the middle of the night, just really hoping for an opportunity to get vaccinated.
Alaska's chief medical officer, Dr. Ann Zink, delivered shots to Canadians herself on a recent visit to Hyder, Alaska. The tiny community hopes vaccinations will help ease restrictions on most travel to its nearest neighbor, the town of Stewart in British Columbia.
Honestly, when I was vaccinating, it was kind of like a block party feel. People were like, I haven't seen you in a year. How are you? It's so good to see you.
She had to take three planes to reach Hyder. The only road access comes through Stewart.
If we can really have that whole community vaccinated, Canada and Hyder will feel more comfortable about allowing those people to move back and forth.
The border closure has also profoundly isolated Point Roberts, Washington, which sits on a peninsula separated from the rest of the state by British Columbia. Fire Chief Christopher Carlton said he'd like to hold drive-in vaccination clinics for American citizens living in Canada or even Canadian vacationers.
They could come down, spend the summer with us, be fully vaccinated with us, and return to Canada safely for the communities that they live in.
He'd need special accommodations at the border from federal authorities for this to happen, like those that made other cross-border clinics possible, including an exemption to Canada's 14-day quarantine for returning travelers. But one more border community wants to achieve vaccination at a larger scale. A hospital administrator in Windsor, Ontario, has asked to have 75,000 excess vaccines offered up by Michigan delivered to Canada, and to send residents of his region to walk-in clinics across the border in Detroit. For NPR News, I'm Emma Jacobs in Montreal.
Sebastian Younger's new book is about a long walk he took with veterans he met covering the war in Iraq along active train lines, which is illegal. Do not try it. Actually, Sebastian Younger's new book is about Genghis Khan, Daniel Boone, runaway slaves, boxing, and the 17th century Dutch scholar Hugo Grotius, to name just a few things. And it's such a slim little book with such a simple title, Freedom. But there's nothing simple about the questions that word evokes. Sebastian also wrote The Perfect Storm, made the Oscar-nominated film Restrepo about an army platoon in Afghanistan with photographer Tim Hetherington, who was killed in Libya before they could take that walk on the railroad lines together. Instead, Sebastian took it with those veterans, and it became the basis of the HBO documentary The Last Patrol. In the new book Freedom, we have glimpses again of that last patrol, but mostly we're in Sebastian's head as he ponders that word, freedom. And Sebastian Younger joins us now. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
To remind people, we spoke with you and the lovely soldier, Brendan O'Byrne, back in 2014 about that walk you guys took. We'll have that story at herenow.org. It seemed an attempt to try to re-enter the country after combat. I mean, Brendan didn't think he fit in. When did it become about the meaning of freedom?
The walk that we took, I mean, we went 400 miles along active railroad lines from D.C. to Philly to Pittsburgh. We thought of ourselves as high-speed vagrants. And the whole time, I realized, like, every night, we were the only people in the world who knew where we were. And as I say in the book, there's a lot of definitions of freedom, but surely that's one of them. So when I set out to write a book about freedom and how humans come by it, how we are able to maintain our autonomy in the face of greater powers, more powerful societies or people, I sort of cast my mind back on this weird trip that we had done. And I thought, that's an example of freedom, among other things. And so I thought I would weave the account of our high-speed vagrancy into a more researched look at how humans have maintained their freedom throughout the ages.
Well, also because you can hold something up to the light and it can look like freedom, but maybe it's not. So you were free as birds, as you say. You were, what was it? You would eat, walk, hide, sleep every day like scripture, true and honest. But you're also skirting these rail officials who would love to arrest you, weather that would love to kill you. suspicious diner owners, and in all of your cases, some demons, you know, dads who might have oppressed. So were you free?
It was a form of freedom. There isn't one kind of freedom. And, you know, what I would say is that the further out you go, the freer you are in one sense, but you're subject to great hardship and danger. We walked the length of Pennsylvania, mostly along the Juniata River, which was sort of the gateway to the unclaimed, what was called Indian lands of the 1700s. And settlers that went in there, they were subject to brutal attacks from the natives and vice versa. I mean, it was a very bloody time. They were enormously free from the government and from the church, but they were not free of danger. And as a result, they had to band together for a kind of mutual defense. And the agreement to defend each other against Indian attacks became itself a kind of social control. And if you were not willing, if you did not carry, as an adult man, if you did not carry a weapon at all times, you were derided, you were mocked, and ultimately banished from the community. So at the end of the day, you know, as freedom goes up, safety goes down, and you have to sort of pick your poison.
Right, right. You write, freedom also is, simply put, the absence of a threat, but that meant that freedom became something to die for. As you say, you have to band together. It was sacred, in which case you're not entirely free anymore. You're committed to that community that is helping you. And so we also see that, you know, people might envy each other's freedom. For instance, you talk about early nomads. This is thousands of years ago. And the farmers might have looked at the hunters in the mountains and said, wow, they're really free. I'm tied to the land. The hunter in the mountain look at the farmer and say, wow, you're so lucky you have a collective. You make food.
Yeah, I mean, it's just different ways of solving the human problem of survival. So the nomads were materially poor, but really were their own authority. There was no way for a king or a monarch, a tyrant, he had no dominion over the nomads. The farmers, of course, could stockpile food. They could accumulate a significant wealth, but they were bound to the land and bound to the social system that they were part of. What I figured out, the book is divided into three sections: run, fight, and think. I try to figure out, how do humans maintain their autonomy in the face of a more powerful oppressor? First of all, you run away, right? Like the Apache in the American Southwest were very materially poor, but they maintained their autonomy for 300 years. The Pueblo societies in the same area, which were very wealthy, they got rolled up by the Spanish almost immediately. So mobility plays a huge role in freedom. And the, what you sacrifice for mobility is material wealth. You just cannot carry all your stuff around. But if you can't outrun your oppressor, you have to outfight them. Humans are virtually the only mammal where the smaller individual or the smaller group can defeat a larger one. The Taliban are a pretty good example, modern day example of this. I abhor them as a regime. They're horrible. But they had no tanks, no artillery, sometimes no air force, no boots. They defeated the most powerful military ever in history. They fought us to a standstill, and now we're leaving, and they will probably control Afghanistan. If the smaller group could not do that, really freedom would not be possible. We would have been defeated by the British, for example, in 1776.
We just got a sense of the span of this elegant little book. And I'm looking at page 77, 78. You go from a 1996 terrible, terrible commuter train accident in which an engineer jumps up to throw a brake. He's got 15 seconds to do it, to save other people. An example of something that only started to happen in the 20th century, people, you know, saving others as opposed to saving their beloved, the people within their community. And then from there, we go to the derivation of the word freedom, which comes from the medieval German. And then we turn the page and we are there in Rome in 73 BCE. And then we're with Grotius, the Dutch scholar, who was the first who tried to extend this love of your own community and damn the enemy to the idea of human rights for all, even those conquered. What did you do here? In the acknowledgments, you list about 30 huge tomes that you've read. What did you do here?
Well, I did a huge amount of research. So it's important to understand that for much of human history, before international law and human rights law, your immediate freedom came from your ability to defend yourselves against an enemy. And eventually, what we decided as a world is that there's international law that all nations must collaborate on, where human rights and human life must be collectively defended. And so you can be a tiny, tiny country, and hopefully, obviously this wasn't true in the run-up to World War II, but hopefully the big bully next door tries to invade you, the world will come to your aid, that your freedom doesn't just depend on being able to defend yourself. But finally, as I say in the book, if a society that's well-organized enough to defend itself against an enemy is well-organized enough to oppress its own members, that brings us to the final chapter of my book, Think. So we have run, fight, and think. If you can't outrun your enemies or outfight them, you're going to have to outthink them. And I talk about the labor movement, you know, around 100 years ago. And, you know, they were completely outgunned, overpowered by the government, by the National Guard. They were fighting for fairness. I mean, the conditions were horrendous. One in five infants died in the immigrant communities. And they eventually won, but they won by basically outthinking the opponent. And, you know, one very important thing to point out is the role of women in those kinds of fights. The labor movement was losing, and then they put women on the front line. And the National Guard soldiers with fixed bayonets didn't know what to do. They were not willing to attack women. And as one frustrated police captain said in Lawrence, Massachusetts in 1912, one cop can handle 10 men, but it takes 10 cops to handle one woman. That was the beginning of the end of the government's ability to basically oppress workers in Massachusetts.
Yeah. Well, as we said, the freedom they were seeking was something that was sacred to them. They were willing to sacrifice for it. Now, you're right, it's taken for granted, which is why, you're right, people can look at other requests for sacrifice. You cite rationing water during a drought and, you know, kind of look at that as government tyranny. I'd say, you know, wearing a mask. Someone can say that is government tyranny.
Well, the word freedom is horribly misused. It's often misused by people who would like to carve out extra rights for themselves or want to create a rationale, a justification for oppressing someone else. What people have to understand is that freedom means freedom from oppression, not freedom from obligation.
That's Sebastian Younger. His new book is Freedom. It's about a walk and so much more. Sebastian, thank you.
Thank you.
You're not alone if you're still unsure what the CDC's new guidance about masks means for you. Even Saturday Night Live poked fun at the confusion in a skit over the weekend.
Hi, we're four friends from three different households.
We're all half-vaxxed and traveling by train from Florida to the UK. One of us is old and severely at risk.
And one of us is a baby.
So how many of us should wear masks and in which order?
And go!
Derek Thompson is staff writer for The Atlantic. He joins us now. Derek, welcome.
Good to be here. Thank you.
And that was funny, maybe, because it's touching on something that many of us are feeling about the new CDC guidance. What do you think?
Well, as they say sometimes, it's funny because it's true. In about 17, 20 days, the CDC went from encouraging people to wear masks when they're outside, even if they are vaccinated, to saying that people who are fully vaccinated don't need to wear a mask in most places, whether they're outside or inside. I think they turned very closely or very sharply from being way too precautious and way too slow to keep up with the evolution of scientific discovery about this virus, to releasing last week a directive that was very confusing. And it was as confusing as the people on SNL made it seem. They seemed to be saying all at once that we had reached a kind of, you know, the VE day of this pandemic, that a lot of people, a lot of companies, a lot of states seemed to interpret this as saying that this was our victory day. But a lot of places were really caught off guard. State officials had no idea that this was coming. Businesses had no idea this was coming. The White House apparently had no idea that this was coming. My feeling is that the CDC is at least notionally in the business of offering public health guidance. But when the White House and state officials are not properly guided and feel like you're shocking them when there's no underlying change in the science, that tells me that the CDC hasn't been particularly clear about leading people through figuring out what to do with their masks as we vaccinate the population.
And I think that's why you describe in a recent piece in The Atlantic why this new guidance is welcomed but weird. You also argue that public health leaders need to reimagine their strategy to better communicate risk going forward, and it could be as easy as having two commandments. What would those commandments be, in your opinion?
Yeah, I have two commandments, just 13 words. Commandment number one is COVID-19 is an indoor aerosol disease. And commandment number two is that vaccination protects you and more vaccinations protect everyone. So why do those 13 words, why do those two commandments communicate so much? Well, I think number one, COVID-19 is an indoor aerosol disease, is so important to get across to people because the CDC just hasn't been clear about the fact that the risk from this disease is so, so much greater indoors than it is out of doors. Even as late as last week, they were saying that as much as 10% of COVID cases seem to be happening outside. That is just false. Better research seems to indicate that only 0.1% of COVID transmission seems to happen outside. That means that 99.9% of COVID cases have been happening inside. We should have been emphasizing this from the get-go, encouraging people to be extremely cautious when they're inside with strangers, especially for a long period of time, and to push activities outside as much as possible. Instead, you had, even late into 2020, states like Pennsylvania and California banning outdoor drinking, banning people taking walks on the beach, closing various playgrounds. This was a very, very confusing way to communicate what this virus actually is, which is an aerosolized disease that spreads effectively indoors. That fact guides masking behavior, or should guide masking behavior, way more clearly than the CDC's guidance over the last few months.
So, Derek, the question is, why do you think the CDC has struggled with messaging so much?
Well, I think there's two explanations. One explanation is that I think they've been trying to play a game of being both a social psychologist and an epidemiologist at the same time. Rather than just tell people the truth, they've tried, I think, to sort of reverse psychologize people into behaving the way that they want to behave. And the reason that this most recent announcement was so confusing is that all of a sudden they seem to stop that and just say, oh, actually, here's what the science said. And turning on a dime, I think, confused a lot of businesses and states. But moreover, I think there's something fair to say about the fact that the CDC has always been extremely precautious. They've always been essentially like our neurotic grandparent. If you Google Salmonella eggs CDC, you will find CDC guidance that says that you shouldn't have soft-boiled eggs. You shouldn't have a runny yolk with your sunny-side-up eggs. Still, lots of people, including myself, make, you know, soft-boiled eggs, sunny-side-up eggs all the time. The CDC has always been in the position of telling people what sort of the boundary of sort of health considerations should be, expecting that we would live inside of it. And in this pandemic, they've been thrust in the role of essentially telling lots of people how they should behave every single second of the day when they step outside their apartment or house. So I think that the CDC didn't adapt to the times. They didn't adapt to the fact that people would look to them to provide daily guidance, and they've really struggled to keep up with that reality.
Well, I don't know about you, but this weekend I forgot a mask when I went to a restaurant, and I just decided that I was going to go in anyway to pick up the food without the mask. I'm vaccinated. The CDC said it was okay. It felt weird, but it was a clear signal to me, Derek, that the CDC has just changed the game here. Derek Thompson, yeah. Staff writer for The Atlantic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.